This program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Hi, everybody. Coming up, Nicole tells your fortune, looking ahead. So get out your crystal and stay tuned with Mistress Nicole. All dressed in leather, you won't forget her. You want to love her and you won't let go. Who's that woman, crazy woman, Nicole?
All right. Welcome to a Wednesday, everyone. It is 10 days before Christmas. We are winding down. And they're actually getting some stuff done in Congress, too. I guess it's because they want to go home for the holidays. You know how that works. So, here we go. A lot on tap today. Let's see. So they passed the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, at something like $768 billion for 1 year. So I don't want to hear any of these idiots in Congress say, how are you going to pay for it, Joe Manchin? Joe Manchin seemed to have no problem at all with $768 billion for 1 year. For military spending, but he's balking at paid family leave and extending the child tax credit, which, by the way, checks went out today for the last time if they don't pass the Build Back Better Act. So put that in your pipe and smoke it. Yeah, it's just unreal. What else did they? Oh, they raised the debt ceiling. So and allegedly it's now raised until 2023. So they won't have to deal with this going into the midterms next year. And they did that by voting a one-time workaround to the filibuster. Go figure. They did that to raise the debt ceiling. They need to do it permanently. Right now, thankfully, there are some members of Congress and others out there who are, screaming that we need to get the Right to Vote Act passed along with the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. If we have any prayer of holding on to this experiment we call a democracy, I know it's not a real democracy, but it's as close as any country really has been. And in the grand scheme of things, we're not very old. What, we're 200 and some odd years? My math sucks. And maybe it's going to end if things continue in the direction that they're going and there aren't protections put in place to protect our vote and the sanctity of the election, then we're screwed and not in a good way. So, there's a lot of stuff that needs to be done. And I don't know that our elected leaders are capable of fixing it. And by our elected leaders, yes, I'm talking about the Democrats. And because I criticize the Democrats doesn't mean that all of a sudden I'm a supporter of the Republicans. Hell no. The only thing worse than today's Democratic leadership is the Republican Party. So, it's bad all around. And the answer, I don't know. I really don't know. So yesterday, Lisa Graves was here, and when I start talking to Lisa, I've got a million questions for her, and she's so knowledgeable that we just went on. But, sorry. I'm trying to figure out how to hang these stained glass. It's not real glass. It's faux stained glass stuff that I have behind me. And the smaller ones, you can see I've got four of them hanging. They're hanging just fine. But I have this bigger one that is like a long sunrise or sunset, whichever way you care to look at it, that just my little taping job is not working. So that's what just fell. But it's not glass. So don't worry. There's no broken glass behind me. And my little four things are still hanging there. All right. Back to the drawing board. I'm becoming very inventive in my old age, trying to figure out how to hang things. Anyway, so yesterday I got carried away with Lisa Graves, and earlier in the day, I had taped an interview, a short interview with Ryan Grimm. I first met Ryan 15 years ago, perhaps, when he was at Huffington Post. when I first got into talk radio. And I've been talking to him ever since. Well, these days he's the Washington Bureau Chief at the Intercept and doing a great job. And he is one of the few in the corporate, well, it's not really the corporate media, he's at the Intercept, one of the few in the visible media who is covering this Medicare privatization scheme. That's what I'm calling it. It's a privatization scheme. And thankfully, there's been, you know, since we started talking about it last week, there has been some action on it. So yesterday, because we didn't get to the Ryan Grimm interview, I did post his article from The Intercept on the blog where yesterday's show was posted, along with an editorial from The Washington Post written by Helene Olin. Also about this, it's called direct contracting. And I want you to know what it's called because you need to be able to speak about it knowledgeably, like you know what you're talking about. And so that's why we're giving you all this information. There were three such experiments. Apparently CMS, the Center for Medicare Services, has something written into the bylaws that allows them to experiment with different programs to bring costs down. This will not do that, by the way. And when it got started under Trump in the final months of the former guy's administration, and for some reason the Biden administration has kept it in place. There were three of these programs. Two of them, they stopped. But the third one is still there. And people are being put into this program. So in just a moment, we're going to hear the interview I recorded yesterday with Ryan Grimm because this information is so important to have. One fact to give you before we get into that is today is December 15th. The healthcare exchanges at healthcare.gov, or if you're in a state that had their own exchange, they're still open. And in fact, they're open for another month through January 15th. So you can sign on to get a health insurance policy. And the costs are much lower now because of the legislation that Congress passed right after Biden got into office. Pandemic relief. I forget what they called the bill. Their naming stuff is not very good. But the gist of that legislation was good. And there's a lot more money in the Affordable Care Act to subsidize our policies. So I urge you, if you don't have health insurance, you got nothing to lose. Go to healthcare.gov. You have till midnight tonight to be covered by January 1st. And if you don't get it done by midnight tonight, you have until January 15th to be covered by February 1st. But January 15th is when open enrollment ends. Take advantage of it. Because right now, frankly, with COVID and everything, you don't want to get sick without insurance. All right? So just a reminder, public service here from the Nicole Sandler Show. Meanwhile, coming up later in the hour, we're going to talk to Will Bunch. Will Bunch, who writes a column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And they're always great. You know, I read it. I think he publishes twice a week. And I could talk to him about each one of his columns. And I actually invited him on the show a few days ago before yesterday's column was published. Oh, and another one fell. Well, I'm learning that my method to hang the faux stained glass is not really... Oh, the one that dropped is actually real stained glass. Oh, well. Or real glass, not... Never mind. Okay. So with that... I guess let's move on. Let's get the Ryan Grimm interview out of the way so I do have time to get to, to get to Will Bunch when it's time for him. It's only Wednesday. Okay. Deep breath. Let's go. Let's welcome Ryan Grimm to the show. Okay. Let's do this. On the line with us now is Ryan Grimm from The Intercept. And Ryan, you've been one of the few people in the media covering this new wrinkle in Medicare. And thank you for doing it, because the more I talk about it, the more I realize how in the dark we are. And this new wrinkle is something called direct
contracting. You've got a piece up at The Intercept today. Medicare privatization scheme faced legal questions about profiteering. What got you started on this subject? How did you become aware that this was even a thing?
That's a good question. I guess Diane Archer had been talking about it, and then there was that congressional letter from Lloyd Doggett and Katie Porter, and I guess, you know, Porter had been speaking out about it. Common Dreams wrote about it.
Right. That's where I first heard about it, that Common Dreams article. And now, thankful today, you have this piece up at The Intercept, and Elaine Olam has a piece up in The Washington Post, which is great. So hopefully more people will learn that this exists. What I'm hearing from listeners is their concern, how do we even know if we're in it? Because this is as opposed to Medicare Advantage, where you opt to get in that program, this one is something that they put you in, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. If your provider is in it, then you're in it, basically.
And you'd have no way of for sure knowing unless you start asking questions and they have to disclose it to you?
Yeah, and I have a couple lists of all the providers that are in it. Although the problem is a lot of these providers own hundreds or thousands of other providers. So that list actually wouldn't be useful.
Wow. Where are you in this? So you're learning about it. We're getting the word out. I emailed with a question from a listener, actually sent me a page from the Center for Medicare website that talked about the Biden administration putting one of these programs on hold. And from you, I learned, well, there were actually three of them. Can you clear that up for me so we know what's still happening?
Right. There was a geographic one, which was designed basically the reimbursement rates that the companies would get would be organized around geography, and if you were in a particular geography, you would basically be put into this no matter what. The details of it are complicated, but to Biden's credit, to the administration's credit, they shut that one down.
Okay.
So that one's on ice. The one that is still going is the one that allows these companies to contract directly with Medicare. And, you know, there's a rationale underneath all of this that I think almost anybody could get behind, which is to say that if you're going to have a profit-based system, which we shouldn't, but we do.
Right.
Even though Medicare is single payer, there are still for-profit providers that Medicare is paying. So even under Medicare, it's a for-profit. You know, incentives are organized around profit.
Right.
So if you're going to organize around profit, it shouldn't be just who can do the most care. Because if it's just who can do the most care, then you have those, you know, the cliche is like everybody getting an MRI at the drop of a hat. Mm-hmm. You got a hangnail, you get an MRI, and government gets billed for the MRI, and then every company takes a piece along the way, that everybody gets rich, and the patient didn't need an MRI.
Right.
And that can actually lead to worse health outcomes because people who need a particular treatment that may be cheaper and may be more effective mm-hmm. might not get that because mm-hmm. it's actually... you make a lot more money to operate or whatever. So if you design the system where the incentive is to get people healthy and make sure that people are healthy, like that's ideal and mm-hmm. that's good. Like you could understand why that there is an underlying principle there that people could agree with.
Right.
The problem comes in when you have people who come in from the private sector who design the program and design the incredibly complicated calculations that pay for this care in such a way that it just maximizes the profit. for these companies. So they basically, they design it so that the annual amount of money that they can get is maximized per patient. And then it's up to them after that to figure out ways to give as little care as possible so that the difference between what they got paid for the annual rate and the amount they spent on care is their profit.
Well, the way I understand it, and please tell me if I'm wrong here, in traditional Medicare, it is a pay-for-service thing where your healthcare provider, your doctor, bills Medicare for the services they provide. It's itemized, basically.
Right. Which has some risks of abuse.
Sure.
But yes, that's the traditional system.
The traditional system. But there has been a move toward getting away from fee-for-service. For instance, Kaiser Permanente out in California, maybe I'm using the term wrong. I was going to say managed care, but I shouldn't use those terms because they have technical meanings. It's where doctors are on salary. Everybody's on salary, and they get paid the same regardless of what procedures, what things they do. So they're treating the whole patient. It's not a fee for service plan. And that was the theory to move into. And so you have like Medicare Advantage, and I believe now these direct contracting plans where the company, the provider, is paid a set amount per patient. And there are all kinds of formulas that I'm reading about with the direct contracting stuff to determine what each patient's risks are, I guess. So the company gets a set amount per patient, say per year. Whatever the health provider doesn't spend on that patient, they get to keep, which to me would disincentivize them from treating the patient, wanting to pocket more money. Do I have that right?
Sort of, yes. And so, and it also incentivizes them to inflate, you know, how sick the person is.
Oh, wow.
And figure out ways
to get the total that they're due per year up.
Right, right. Okay. And so if you look at Medicare Advantage patients versus traditional patients and compare their risk scores, which is how
the risk scores, yes,
and how much money you get for these people, the ones in Medicare Advantage are like wildly sicker compared to, but they're not actually sicker. It's just like that's how they pencil whipped the paperwork. And the problem is that we don't take it far enough in the direction that it needs to go. Like there's a great article in the New Yorker a couple weeks or months ago about Costa Rica's approach to healthcare through a public health lens, that it's organized around public health, making communities and people healthier. And as a result, they spend like 10% of what we do and have absolutely better health outcomes than we do. Like just not even relative to income or anything, but just straight up healthier than we are because they focus on public health.
Right.
We actively resist a focus on public health. In fact, insurance companies, there was a statement that went around recently that was saying, look, if you need to get a test for COVID for a public health reason, then that is therefore not covered by our insurance. Like the only thing that insurance companies will cover is your private health.
Huh. Interesting. You know, it's funny because my husband is on a Medicare Advantage plan only because the upfront costs are less and it's what we can afford right now. The whole thing is back ass words, right? So he's on that. Yesterday, you know, and his Medicare Advantage company is AvMed, and all of his communications come from AvMed. Well, yesterday he got something in the mail from Medicare about his Part B services, and the two things that were itemized on this statement were his COVID vaccines. So interesting that came straight through Medicare, but everything else comes through AvMed. I guess this is relating to that. He rarely gets any communications from Medicare at all. The only thing he got was this thing relating to the vaccines, which is COVID. So
right, and it's probably easier for whoever gave him the vaccine to just work directly with Medicare.
Interesting.
So, and actually, when I got mine, and I heard this from a lot of other people, they said, please put uninsured.
Oh wow, interesting.
Because like because then we don't have to deal with anybody.
Yeah, because I noticed, you know, I have insurance through the Affordable Care Act, and I got a thing where my insurance company was charged for the vaccine for the first one, but I haven't gotten anything on the second one or the third one yet. But the first one that I went through, Holy Cross Hospital, it charged them, and I thought they're free. But I guess if you have insurance, they'll charge the insurance company. If you're uninsured, it's technically free.
Well, they charge the government.
Of course, yeah. Right. But you don't know. Right.
Right. And so because we don't go all the way, we only go halfway with what they call accountable care or value-driven care. Mm-hmm. They like the idea is right that the value ought to be health, but you're still leaving it in the hands of these McKinsey driven consultant fueled for-profit companies who can look at the spreadsheet and say, what is the way for us to maximize the amount of money that we get out of this? Now, if you could perfectly design it so that the consultants say, look, the best way to do this is to genuinely make your people healthier in the whatever way you could possibly can, mm-hmm. then okay. But we haven't gotten to that place. Like the closest we've gotten was where it's very simple, where it's a good example is there kept being hospital reinfections from, you know, staff infections from, people post-surgery getting infections, sure. And then a week or two later, they're back. Some of them dying. It can be extremely dangerous. Some of this is, you know, MRSA, like resistant to antibiotics, this is dangerous stuff. And so in the Affordable Care Act, they told hospitals, your reinfection rate is going to be influenced, is going to influence how much money you get from the government. And so you need to get your reinfection rate down, your readmittance rate down. And lo and behold, they hired some more staff. They cleaned the rooms better. They cleaned the equipment better, and boom, they smashed reinfections and readmissions way down. And so there are ways, because before there was not only was there no incentive for them to do it beyond getting sued, but a readmittance was more business.
Right.
So there was almost a morbid kind of disincentive to do it. You know, what you find that sweet spot between malpractice and more business.
Right.
This changed the financial incentive. And as a result, hospitals, by and large, literally cleaned up their act.
Wow.
And saved lives as a result. So you can do this, mm-hmm. but having it designed by people whose mission is not this, but is profit, is not going to get you there.
Right. Well, that's the thing about this direct contracting. So Medicare Advantage, it is a health insurance company running these plans, but the direct contracting, if I'm reading it correctly, in many cases, they're financial programs, they're investment, they're venture capitalists. They're not necessarily health providers or insurance companies, right? It could be anybody who just sets up one of these deals.
Right. And it's a lot of venture capital backed,
right.
Like new entrants, as they call them. And Archer says in my Intercept story today, like the end game for both these VC backed companies and these private equity backed companies is the exit strategy is to get bought out by insurance companies.
Yeah, the whole thing about, you know, making healthcare a profit driven industry is reprehensible. That's the problem here. And then in your Intercept story, I see you write at the center of this privatization project now that Joe Biden is in the White House is Liz Fowler, who was previously the lead healthcare staffer for Max Baucus. Max Baucus was the guy who killed the public option in the original Obamacare negotiations. He was part of the Joe Manchin of 10 years ago, wasn't he?
Yes, and before that she worked for insurance companies, and after that she worked for drug companies.
Oh my God.
Right. And what really puts the lie to this whole scheme is what we were just talking about, that the goal of these VC firms and these private equity firms is not health. It's an exit. And they are very clear about that. Like when they get in to an investment, they're not trying, like almost very, 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 very few of them, like 1%, are trying to build a company that they will then operate for even at a profit for the indefinite future. Like that's not how capitalism works.
Right.
The goal is you're 10X, you're 20X, you put your investment in, you build a company, and then you either take it public and bounce out, or you sell it to somebody who's rolling up the industry.
Right.
And so private equity is rolling up a lot of physicians' practices, and both private equity and VCs are selling out to health insurance companies. Like that's their exit strategy, trying to get that 10X. And so just to understand that allows you to understand the fact that this is not about making people healthier. Like that's not what they're trying to do.
No,
they're trying to cook books in a way that makes it look appealing to a health insurance company, so they can get bought,
right?
And then go do it all over again.
Yeah,
after their 3-year non-compete is over.
Wow, this whole thing is so disconcerting. And something I think that I read in your article, I read a few things this morning on it, so forgive me if it wasn't from your piece, but I think it was Andy Slavitt, who was the guy who he's now involved in one of these.
Yes, I don't, and of course he's saying that his is going to serve underserved communities.
Oh, please.
That's the Democratic approach to this. But yes, both parties, the people who worked in these health agencies, almost to a person and almost to a man, Liz Fowler is one of the few women. That's not true. Seema Verma under Trump was a head honcho. Almost to a person are like in running these types of companies.
Wow.
I mean, they've seen the numbers. They're like, whoa.
So, hey, let's get in on this windfall. Screw, making Medicare for all work the way it's supposed to and for everyone. Now let's just get in on the windfall and make some money. Yeah. Wow, that's depressing. So, great. Now we're talking about it. This is out in the open. This best kept secret about this latest scam to privatize Medicare is out in the open. What do we do about it? Is Liz Fowler is obviously in Biden's good graces, right? He's got her blessing, or she has his blessing. Well,
one thing I pointed out in a recent piece, not this one, but a different one, is that Susan Rice is head of Domestic Policy Council. Uh-huh. Her whole experience is in foreign policy.
Right.
And even if it were in domestic policy, this is not a top 10 issue because it's not moving voters.
Wow.
Because it's not getting talked about. Now you could see how it eventually could, if it got out, it certainly could. But it's just, and so what it does is it allows people who are smart, sophisticated, and understand the system, like a Fowler or like other people who've been in that position before, to basically run it as a fiefdom, to run it, how they best see fit without a lot. It's not like they have to run a lot through the very top echelons of the administration because it's just not on their radar.
Mm-hmm. So what our challenge now is getting it out there, talking to our congressperson, our senators, and getting it in the press. Glad it's in The Intercept today and The Washington Post. We need to make people aware that this is out there and let our elected representatives know that it's not acceptable.
Basically, because it wouldn't, I don't think, withstand a lot of scrutiny.
Yep. Wow. Thank you for doing your part. I when I first heard about this from that Common Dreams article, I was astounded, and I'm thinking, all right, this has got to be extra spin on it. But the more I read about it, the more frightening it becomes, frankly. We're moving in the wrong direction. We were supposed to be moving toward Medicare for all, toward, it working the way it was envisioned to work, not like this. So, Ryan Grimm, thank you. Thank you for your work on this.
There you go. Ryan Grimm, of course, from The Intercept, thankfully writing about this direct contracting scam. I'll call it a scam because it basically is. All right. We're going to move on. Will Bunch is going to be with us in just a moment. I think I need to remind him because he said something to me about, because of my ADD, don't, you know, remind me. So that's something else Will Bunch and I have in common, because I certainly have this adult ADD. So I'll tell you what, in the spirit of the season, I got another little song to play for you, and I will try to raise Will Bunch. He hopefully will be with us when we return. enjoy. Oh God, what do these people go by? What name do they go? I forget. I'll tell you on the back end. Do I have it here? Hold on. A man, woman, camera, thing. That's what they go by. Enjoy. DeSantis laws are coming to town. Here we go.
Don't care if you cough. Don't care if you sneeze. You take that mask off and he's not saying please. DeSantis laws are coming to town. He made a decree. You cannot dissent. To him, liberty is your mom on a vent. DeSantis laws are coming to town. He sees you when you're masking. He knows if you've been vexed. If you try to save your students, you will get your funding axed.
Whoa,
you better watch out. Stand back and stand by. Cause there is no doubt that he wants you to die. DeSantis laws are coming to town. Who cares if you kill your favorite classmate? The virus has found a sanctuary state. DeSantis laws are coming to town.
While others take pains to avoid a breakthrough, he welcomes all strains from Alpha to Mu.
DeSantis laws are coming to town. If you rant against Pfizer, he'll give you a safe space.
He probably drinks Budweiser just to pander to his base.
Oh, thank God for the courts. They don't like this clown. Prepare your passports, cause they're striking him down. DeSantis laws ain't coming to town. DeSantis laws ain't coming to town.
Yeah. DeSantis, just in case you were wondering, I just got a message from Will Bunch that says, help. your message doesn't have the Zoom link. Okay, hold on. I just sent it to you, Will. Hold on 1 second. We got to get the Zoom link again for Will Bunch. Let me copy this and send it to him here again. It's always something. If it's not one thing, it's another. Here we go. Hold on. Will Bunch will be with us momentarily, I'm sure. So, just a little heads up for something that's coming next week. You know, next week are the holidays. So Christmas is, well, it's after next week, but okay. So, today, this time of year, I always get confused. So I have my physical calendar here. So today is Wednesday the 15th. We have Howie tomorrow. I'm not quite sure what we're doing Friday yet, we'll do something good. And then next week, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday are the 20th, 21st, and 22nd. So we'll do something. I'm actually filling in for Brad Friedman those days as well. So I got a lot of programming to cover. But also, the 23rd is Thursday, when Howie Klein is always here, but the 23rd of December is Festivus. So I want you to start thinking, because Festivus is the day you air your grievances. So we will open it up so you can air your grievances. And God knows we've all got a lot of grievances these days, right? So prepare for that. All right. And then we'll, but this morning I taped another interview with the Marsh family, and hopefully you know who they are. And if you don't, then you've missed out on the best pandemic silver lining ever, because the Marsh family is his family from Kent, England, who sings. And they did these parody songs throughout the pandemic, mostly dealing with the pandemic, but other things too. And they're just brilliant. They're adorable. They sing beautifully, and they've gone viral. And so one of those days I'll feature the interview with them, because it's the holidays and we want to lighten things up. But it's not the holidays yet, and we're not light at all. So joining us now is Will Bunch. You can read him at the Philadelphia Inquirer. The shortcut to your work, your page at the Philadelphia Inquirer still works. I used to always find you when you were with the Daily News at attitude.com, and it still works. It takes you to the Will Bunch page. So I just put that up as a kind of a shortcut on the Chiron there. But hi, Will.
Hey, Nicole, how you doing? Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming. You know, I was telling the listeners, I could probably talk to you every time you have a column. And you're out twice a week, you publish, right?
Actually, it's crazy, but I actually write three times a week.
Three times.
I know most average columnists do too. The thing is, my column kind of started as a blog, right?
Right.
So when I was blogging, unlike some bloggers, I wasn't doing five posts a day, but I was doing at least one post every day. So I was writing five times a week. Now, some of those posts were really short because they were blog posts.
Right.
But I was used to being out there every day. So when I went to columnist, I said, all right, well, why don't I try 3 days, even though two was the normal. So, cause I didn't want to lose that kind of blog. I mean, to me, I'm still a blogger at heart after all these years. You know, I'm one of those people who's very nostalgic for the blogging era. So, I try to keep that. But what has changed though is two of my columns are kind of traditional columns, and they run in the print edition of the Inquirer for people who live in the Philadelphia area, as well as online. And then the third thing I do during the week, every Tuesday, is the Will Bunch newsletter, which
right.
is a new thing that we added early in 20. In fact, we added it. In fact, we started it right when the pandemic was starting. So it's a few weeks younger than the pandemic, but so it comes every Tuesday. And unlike the other stuff, you don't have to worry about paywalls or having right. a subscription or anything. You can just sign up. It takes 5 seconds. It's totally free, and you'll get it around 11 o'clock every Tuesday morning in your inbox. So I would definitely encourage people to go sign up.
Without a doubt. Because
the Will Bunch newsletter.
I had already invited you to come on the show today when I got your newsletter yesterday. And what I was going to talk to you about was, I want to ask you about Dr. Oz running for the Senate and a few other things going on in Pennsylvania. But your newsletter yesterday was about, the headline is Tornadoes Rip the Roof Off of American Capitalism. And this, as all your stuff is, this was really good. So we should start with that, because we witnessed a weather event, something unusual for December for sure, with a swath of tornadoes wreaking havoc, devastation on five or six states, most notably Kentucky. But wow, this is unheard of. And obviously, it's so weird hearing TV commentators, you know, trying to step around climate change. We're not sure if we can draw a correlation. Yes, you can draw a correlation.
Right, because December is not tornado season.
No.
These are the kind of tornadoes you would usually see in March or April when spring is starting
That's
to
right.
change over, or when the winter is starting to give way to spring, is when you would normally see pockets of warm air meeting pockets of cold air, not in the middle of December. And, right before this event, you had had places in the Midwest that were 15, 20 degrees among the normal above the normal temperature for this time of year. So, clearly that played a huge role. I don't know if you've seen this, because I know you've been on the air, and I don't know about your listeners, but I've just in the last couple hours seen a lot of reports on Twitter and elsewhere about these new dust storms that are hitting Oklahoma, Nebraska, Iowa.
Really?
Again, you know, unusually hot weather for that, for this time of year. Dry land, so there's a lot of dust because there's been drought. And now these winds that are up to 70 miles an hour, you know, almost hurricane force winds sweeping across the Midwest. I mean, it looks like the Dust Bowl. In fact, I said on Twitter, you know, it's like, well, we didn't get another FDR, but we got another Dust Bowl, you know, so.
Right.
Unfortunately. So yes, I mean, climate's big. And, you know, I mean, the other thing I would say, though, is, I mean, the reason I wanted to write a column about what happened in Kentucky is there were two things that struck me about that. And one is, you're absolutely right, is the climate. And the other was just what the tragedy said about the American way of work nowadays, because the two kind of epicenters of devastation, right, were both these very modern industrial sites. One was an Amazon, I guess technically not a warehouse, I guess delivery depot is what they call it, in Illinois, near southern Illinois, near St. Louis. And the other was this candle factory in Mayfield, Kentucky, right, which is just sounds like the, you know, low wage workplace from HE double toothpicks, right? You know, people working for as little as $8 an hour, because they were having trouble finding workers at that pay rate, augmented by some jail inmate labor, right?
They yep. have a, and there were yeah. all, luckily the, I guess luckily there were only seven of them there. Seven.
Yes, and of course they were, you know, of course these inmates were the ones who were helping out the most, and you know, I guess they were younger, stronger men perhaps that were helping to try and free people from the damage. So
right.
Because you know, I mean, we're all people, and it's just a human tragedy, you know, what happened here. But you have to ask yourself, you know, I mean, all right, it's Christmas season. These companies are crazed trying to, you know, make all their profits in 1 month of the year. And you've got these, meanwhile, I mean, they've been warning about these storms all day. And in the minutes before the tornadoes, they had more specific warnings that the tornadoes were coming into these specific areas. And yet there are serious questions about how much warning people had, whether people who wanted to leave were allowed to leave.
Right. The stories that I heard is people right. who asked if we could leave were told yeah. you'll be fired if you leave.
Yeah. At the candle factory, there was a report that people begged to leave and were told they would be fired. And now, you know, now eight of these people
are dead,
died in the tornado.
And listen to this from the chat room. Louise says of the 190 individuals at the Amazon fulfillment site, only six were Amazon employees. The rest were subcontractors with no legal redress for any kind of support.
Right. That's their business model now is exactly. And, you know, they're under really no obligation to these people.
Wow.
It's amazing, you know, and the thing is, we need to start thinking about climate change and the workforce. And here's another argument for having union. I would say strong unions, but in this case, it would be just having unions, period. Right. To negotiate for worker safety, because, you know, clearly these facilities did not have shelters that could stand up to these tornado force winds. And,
nope.
We need to start thinking about that, you know, these workplaces are affected by climate change in so many ways. You know, we've seen so many stories about excessive heat in Amazon warehouses and workers collapsing or even dying because of, you know, because of too much heat exposure, right? You know, there's tornadoes, there's hurricanes, there's floods, all of the, you know, and these are wide open buildings that are very ill equipped to handle the stress of high winds.
Mm-hmm.
They're built on slabs, you know, if there's, heaven forbid, if there's a flash flood or something, you know, they're just very dangerous places to work, and people, you know, and we should be paying these people a living wage to do this.
A living wage. You know, I got to tell you, one of the guests that I interviewed this year, I had Joe Walsh on the show, not the guitar player, but the former congressman,
yes.
who is also a former right-wing crazy. Now he says he's seen the light. He's still conservative. He's still Republican, but he's a you know, a never Trumper, thankfully, and at least is not afraid to say, yes, I was a jerk back then and I was wrong and I apologize. But one thing we still disagree on is the idea that somebody working a full-time job should earn a living wage. He doesn't get that. And that's a real difference between us and them. How could you say somebody who's working 40 hours shouldn't be able to support themselves, at least themselves, and half a family is beyond me.
I mean, what Sherrod, you know, Senator Sherrod Brown from Ohio calls the dignity of work, right? You know, I mean, I think for progressives that is or should be, in most cases, is a core value, right? Mm-hmm. And it does, you know, the entrepreneurial mindset of Republicans is focused on the business owner, and there are a lot of small business owners in the Republican Party, and I understand that small business owners are a bedrock of the economy. They need to make money. I think when small business owners complain that they're overregulated and there's too much red tape, I think they're making a good point. But at the bottom line, if people who are not owners but are workers, if they don't have basic safety, and if they don't have basic dignity in the workplace, and if they don't make enough money to support their families without food security or having to use food stamps, or then the system is broken. So again, that's why, getting back to the headline of my piece, I think these tornadoes kind of rip the roof off of what it's like inside these boxes that we normally don't see inside what conditions are like for these workers. Obviously no one had ever heard of the Mayfield Consumer Products candle factory, though I guess if you shop at the Bath and Body Works, you possibly have purchased their products.
Sure.
Everything I've read about this place sounds like, it's a trade-off. I mean, people need jobs, they need to make some money, and people will take these jobs for $8 an hour, or even, $10 or $11 or $12 once they've worked there a couple of years. But even then, but they're just very difficult places to work. There's, mandatory overtime, which is great, you get paid. But, when you're working 50 or 60 hours every week and not seeing your family, it can put stress on your relationships.
Right. And even with overtime pay, if it's based on a $7.25 an hour minimum wage, even if it's double pay, it's still, what, $14.50? You can't live on that.
I mean, some of these labor situations over the summer that I followed, one of them is still ongoing, this Kellogg strike, and also the Frito-Lay strike over the summer that was resolved. I mean, these were huge issues where people were, it's like, if you want to keep your job, you have to work 60 or 70 hours a week. And like, all right, so you've got a few extra bucks in your paycheck, but you also don't have much of a life, because this work is exhausting, right? I mean, it's hard, is a career long desk jockey, it's hard enough, it's hard enough to sit at a desk and do that type of work for 60 hours a week. But imagine working in these factories for 60 hours a week,
And for pennies to get out of there and then have to go to another job to put food on the table for your kids, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I remember that clip. It's an audio bite. I've got it somewhere, but I'm not going to go digging for it. But it's George W. Bush, someone at a town hall saying to him, I work three jobs. And he's like, three jobs? That's amazing. That's great. That's uniquely American. Like, he doesn't get it.
He wasn't wrong, was he?
No, he wasn't wrong.
It is uniquely American.
But it's not great.
no, it's not. It's not. It's not making America great.
No, not again, in again any or ever by any stretch of the imagination. So, yeah. Will Bunch, I hope people do subscribe to the newsletter and read this column. Tornadoes rip the roof off of American capitalism. It's also posted at the Philadelphia Inquirer under with all your other stuff. While I've got you, I got to ask you about Mehmet Oz. I guess he's going to be mad at me because I didn't call him Dr. Oz.
Yes.
As if that's his name.
You're part of the cancel culture. You're canceling his American success story.
Right. So, now, does he live in Pennsylvania?
No, he does not. He claimed last year when he started thinking about this, he claimed residency at his in-law's house, which I'm not exactly 100% sure how that's legal, but he owns a large mansion overlooking the Manhattan skyline in North Jersey. A short commute to his studio in New York, which is where New York City, which is where he tapes his show. And we've got at least one and possibly two other Republican Senate candidates in Pennsylvania also don't live here, but this one guy, David McCormick, who's a hedge fund, billionaire who may or may not join the race. At least he grew up in Pennsylvania. I'm not supporting his candidacy in any sense, but I mean, at least he can claim that he grew up in Pennsylvania and he went to high school here and he's from a middle-class family and all this stuff. I mean, you know, Mehmet Oz says that he went to Penn for 6 years. So that's his entire Philadelphia or Pennsylvania and Philadelphia experience. And, so I think people are insulted, you know, and is it so often the case, you know, his efforts to try and be a Pennsylvanian are just so transparently phony. I mean, I guess it was just yesterday he went to Pittsburgh and, he was out there with the Pittsburgh skyline behind him, not wearing an overcoat, which is no one would ever go to Pittsburgh in December and not wear an overcoat unless they've never been there before. But, and he's taping this video. And at some point he said, I couldn't even watch the whole thing, but apparently at some point he said something like, well, you know, I like beer and sandwiches, you know? So I guess he didn't even specify
hoagie.
I don't know.
Philly cheesesteak.
I don't know if it would have been worse or better if he had said, you know, Iron City beer he's probably never heard of Iron City beer, you know. I mean, I lived in Western Pennsylvania for 5 months, 40 years ago, and I know all about Iron City beer, but, he doesn't know our state. And, you know, and that's not the only bad thing about his candidacy. I mean, you know, like all the very, very much like Donald Trump, you know, he just reinvented himself as this, you know, pro-life, anti-abortion zealot, holding up babies and talking about the sanctity of human life. When just 2 years ago, when he wasn't thinking about running for office, somebody asked him about Roe versus Wade and abortion. And he actually, and I think the guy's a quack, but on this, he actually gave a pretty eloquent defense of abortion rights 2 years ago. And now he's an anti-abortion guy. The bulk of his campaign is just the vague, you and I could sit down for 15 minutes, Nicole, and come up with a better thought out platform than he has. His ads, he talks about how he's lived the American dream and he's a success story. And now he believes in freedom and it's nothing, you know. I mean,
yeah. Didn't he come up through Oprah? Like he was a guest on her show, wasn't? Isn't that?
Yes,
he came up through. So how does? I mean, I wonder what Oprah Winfrey would have to say about Dr. Oz today. This Trumper, right wing.
I mean, for somebody, I mean, I know it was great when she, you know, campaigned for Obama and all that stuff, but it seems like at this stage she's wreaked more havoc on progressive politics than she's helped out.
That's right. Between
it's very strange.
Lot of the people who she brought, Dr. Phil. I mean, she's got these quacks who came up through her network, her show, right?
Quack, quacks and politically horrible to the extent that they have politics. And
yeah,
it's very weird, isn't it?
I mean, it really is when you think about it. Look at the people she brought to us. Like, wow. I wonder what she would have to say about them today.
Yeah, and this Mehmet Oz character, I mean, it's almost a shame because it seems like he was started his career as quite a reputable and, you know, he had a good reputation, and he was on the faculty. I think he still is actually on the faculty at Columbia University.
Really?
And, you know, was apparently did like invent some useful, heart, products for heart surgery. And it's like once the TV lights started shining on him, he couldn't help himself from like endorsing all kinds of weird, he was out there last year talking about, I can never pronounce it quite properly, but this
hydroxychloroquine.
Hydroxychloroquine. I always leave out a syllable. Yeah. Hydroxychloroquine, yeah.
Wow. And probably now ivermectin. He's probably pushed. You know, it's this alternate reality. I guess
it's like a drug, though. It's like they've been it's like a cult. They've been
it
lost.
Is a cult.
They get lost. They get absorbed into this cult and they just adopt, it's like, horse dewormer for COVID. I'm all
sure.
In,
why know? Not? Sure. Why yeah. not? Well, it makes as much sense as this. I found the clip. Here it is.
I work three jobs and I feel like I contribute.
You work three jobs?
Three jobs, yes.
Uniquely American, isn't it? I mean, that is fantastic that you're doing that.
No, it isn't.
Oh, my God.
I guess that's fantastic. No, it is not fantastic. It's sickening that she has to work three jobs. And
when I think about people working three jobs, I think about you probably remember this, a story maybe 3 or 4 years ago about the woman who, collapsed because she was going to her 6 a.m. job at Dunkin' Donuts, which was like her third job of the day. And I mean, that's the reality. I guess that's a uniquely American death. I guess so.
This is what we should be working towards changing. So in the few minutes we have left, Will Bunch, and it's only like two, I see Congress was very busy this week. They got the debt ceiling done. They got the NDAA done. And by the way, Joe Manchin didn't question where the $768 billion for 1 year funding our military, how that's going to be paid for. That's not an issue for him, but paid family leave is?
Yeah, I think somewhere in that NDAA process, if I'm not mistaken, they actually just threw an extra $10 or $20 billion dollars.
More than Biden asked for. We pulled out of Afghanistan this year. You would think our military budget could drop a little bit because we're not supporting this 20-year-old war.
Right. I mean, you and I are old enough to remember the peace dividend. Remember that? Never really came.
No.
And where's the Afghanistan peace dividend? That was not the whole point, but that was part of the point of leaving Afghanistan.
This is double, more than double, if they had stayed at the original $3.5 trillion over 10 years. That still, for 1 year, would only be less than half of what they're spending on this bloated military budget when we're not technically at war anywhere.
It's just been a very frustrated week, I've been juggling a few things this afternoon, so I haven't fully wrapped my arms around what's been happening up on Capitol Hill today. But, apparently, the prospects for the Build Back Better. Yeah. I mean, I hate that name. But
so do I. I hate the name of everything. Democrats have a messaging problem, but they also have a Manchin problem.
Yeah. So this bill, which has child tax credits, which has pre-K, which was going to have possibly some family leave in it, and which has large climate change provisions, not everything that should be in there, but it still had a big climate change component. This bill, it's not going to happen in 2021. They say they're pushing it back to next year, maybe, but I think there comes a point where you keep pushing it back, it's just not going to happen.
Right. And the progressives gave up the leverage they had on it.
Yeah. And Schumer's trying to save face by saying we're pivoting to voting rights, but I don't see that happening either. And Biden has done nothing on student loans,
Nothing.
It's just, it's, it's, it's a really bad look, you know. I mean, I've been very focused on January 6th, and I'm glad that they're getting to the bottom of, you know, starting to get to the bottom of what Trump did. And it's a huge story. It's important. But they're just blowing it on the other stuff.
I know. It's depressing. We need to change the narrative. They need to turn it around. And frankly, if they're not going to stay in D.C. through the holidays and get not only Build Back Better through, but do something about the assault on our voting rights, on our whole election system, right, then they shouldn't even bother coming back from their winter break, because there'll be nothing to come back to.
I'm just as disgusted as you are. I really am, you know. And it's partly Manchin, but you know, there's a lot of blame to go around.
Yes, so. There's plenty of blame to go around. But right now, we don't need blame. We don't need finger pointing. We need to fix this. The problem is leadership, and I don't know that we have the right people in place to do it. To see Nancy Pelosi today was asked to. There was a Business Insider report yesterday about 14 members of Congress, and I think it was 8 Republicans and 6 Democrats, who were guilty of violating the Stock Act, the insider trading, basically. And Nancy Pelosi was asked today, should members of Congress be able to trade? And she's like, oh, yeah, it's capitalism. This is what the country is built on. Well, no, because obviously they're not responsible enough not to use the insider information that they're privy to game the system. And if you can't do that, then you shouldn't have the right at all.
Like, wasn't another thing is, wasn't this supposed to be her last term as speaker? And now apparently it may not be.
It may not be.
I mean, she just will not let go. And I mean, the Democrats, they've got to build their next generation. You know, it's like, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen in 2024, but, you know, it's just a big mess, you know. There's problems with Biden running again. There's problems with Kamala Harris. But if for some reason, if not those two, who, you know?
I've got a few thoughts. Katie Porter, Pramila Jayapal, who I don't think can be president, but she can be Speaker of the House. Let's, you know. But this is a topic for another day because we're already over time. Will Bunch, again, find him at the Philadelphia Inquirer, inquirer.com. How did they sign up for the newsletter again?
It's inquirer.com/Bunch.
It takes
5 seconds. You've got to enter your email address. That's all you got to do.
That's it. It's all free. Okay. And then you at least get one Will Bunch column delivered to your inbox each week. And one is certainly better than none.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Nicole.
Thank you, Will. It's great to see you again. And I always read you. I read you even if we don't talk, but it's always great to talk to you. Thanks again.
Yes, same here. You take care, Nicole.
You too. Bye-bye. All right. So with that, we're done. That's it for what day is today? Wednesday. And tomorrow's Thursday, Howie Klein will be here. And, you know, we'll go through it. I'm going to leave you with the news because, well, we can. Thanks for hanging, everyone. See you tomorrow.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Well, it was a busy day Tuesday on Capitol Hill. The House voted 222 to 208 to hold Mark Meadows, the former White House chief of staff under Donald Trump, in contempt of Congress for defying a subpoena issued by the January 6th committee. Representatives Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger were the only Republicans to vote for the resolution. Meadows, a former congressman from North Carolina, had initially complied with the committee. He turned over emails and texts, some 9,000 pages of them, but then stopped cooperating and failed to appear for his deposition last week. The vote by the full House followed Monday night's unanimous vote by the committee to recommend the criminal contempt charges. They made the case for why Meadows' testimony was needed for their investigation in dramatic fashion. Liz Cheney, the vice chair of the committee, reading text messages sent to Meadows during the attack on the Capitol from members of Congress, Fox News hosts, and even Donald Trump Jr.
Mark, the president needs to tell people in the Capitol to go home. This is hurting all of us. He is destroying his legacy, Laura Ingraham wrote. Please get him on TV, destroying everything you have accomplished Brian Kilmeade texted, quote, can he make a statement? Ask people to leave the Capitol, Sean Hannity urged. As the violence continued, one of the president's sons texted Mr. Meadows, quote, he's got to condemn this shit ASAP. The Capitol Police tweet is not enough, Donald Trump Jr. texted. Meadows responded, quote, I'm pushing it hard. I agree. Still, President Trump did not immediately act. Donald Trump Jr. texted again and again, urging action by the president. Quote, we need an Oval Office address. He has to lead now. It has gone too far and gotten out of hand, end quote. But hours passed without necessary action by the president.
Afterwards, Cheney proclaimed that these non-privileged texts are further evidence of President Trump's supreme dereliction of duty during those 187 minutes. The criminal contempt referral now goes to the Justice Department for possible prosecution. Interesting comment by Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who told reporters that he was not in contact with Meadows during the attack on the Capitol, but added,
but I do think we're all watching, as you are, what is unfolding on the House side. And it will be interesting to reveal all the participants who were involved.
So McConnell, who fought against the committee, is now looking forward to the results of their work, revealing all the participants who were involved. All righty then. By the way, the voting on the contempt charge was halted for around 40 minutes after Republicans were offended by something Steny Hoyer said. It appears the offending comment was offered in this clip.
Legitimate election. He voted against certifying the election of the President of the United States. So I'm not surprised that the gentleman from Indiana does not want to see this subpoena honored because, Madam Speaker, I believe that he fears the information that would be brought forward.
It seems to me that my friend, the gentleman from Maryland, disparaged the gentleman from Indiana here personally and should have his words taken down.
Is the gentleman making a demand
that words be taken
down? Yes, I am.
I don't know what was so offensive, but they demanded that those words be removed from the record. What I find interesting is the fact that this episode happened not too long after Marjorie Taylor Greene called Democrats communists.
I rise in opposition to this resolution to hold Mark Meadows in contempt of Congress because it's being held by nothing but a kangaroo court. Congress's job is to make laws, not enforce them. That's the role of the executive and the judicial branch of this government. But somehow the communists here in charge have forgotten, or no, not forgotten, are purposely abusing the Constitution and what this body of Congress is supposed to do.
Which is more offensive? The Senate was also busy on Tuesday. They voted 50-49 along party lines to approve a $2.5 trillion debt ceiling increase that lawmakers expect to extend the nation's borrowing ability well into 2023. This was only possible after Congress cleared a separate piece of legislation last week, giving the Senate a one-time exemption from the 60-vote threshold needed to pass the debt limit hike because of the filibuster with a simple majority vote. It was an unusual maneuver resulting from a compromise between the Senate leaders to lift the debt limit with only Democratic votes, but also avoid the budget reconciliation process. So the Senate voted Tuesday to raise the debt ceiling. All Democrats backed it. All Republicans opposed it. One Republican was out sick, so it passed by 50-49. Up next, a final vote on the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act,
today
is likely in the Senate on Wednesday. So while they're getting some things done, there are a couple of things still on the table. Build Back Better and voting rights. And there is a major push to get those voting rights done. And all they need is another deal to suspend the filibuster or get rid of it entirely. Senator Mark Warner on Tuesday tweeted, quote, the Senate has shown it cannot do its basic duty and find 60 senators to support basic voting rights. So I support changing the rules around the filibuster for voting rights legislation. I suggest Senator Warner talk with his friends, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Washington, D.C.'s Attorney General Carl Racine on Tuesday filed a lawsuit against the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers over their alleged role in the January 6th attack. The lawsuit holds those far-right groups responsible for the violence by a mob of the former guy's supporters trying to prevent lawmakers from certifying Trump's election loss. The lawsuit invokes a modern version of the Ku Klux Klan Act to seek large financial penalties. An attorney representing two of the defendants called the lawsuit a fantasy targeting the wrong people. Yeah, right. Moving on to COVID, federal health officials warned on Tuesday that the fast-spreading Omicron variant could peak with a big wave of infections that could overwhelm hospitals as soon as January. Pfizer on Tuesday announced that a study confirmed that its coronavirus pill helps prevent severe COVID-19. The drug maker said the antiviral pill also proved effective in laboratory studies against the new Omicron variant, which is expected to overtake Delta as the dominant strain in the U.S. within weeks. Donald Trump's legal troubles keep piling up. On Tuesday, U.S. District Judge Trevor McFadden ruled that the Treasury Department can release the former guy's tax records to the House Ways and Means Committee. McFadden, by the way, is a former Trump Justice Department official. He put the ruling on hold pending a likely appeal, but at least things are moving. And finally, the Associated Press reported Tuesday on a review of every flagged ballot by Trump and others in the 2020 presidential election. And they found that there were fewer than 475 potential cases of voter fraud in the six battleground states that the former guy disputed. Far too few to change the results of the 2020 presidential election. President Biden beat Trump in Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin by a total of 311,257 votes. The Associated Press also found that there was no collusion among the people who cast the fraudulent ballots. Trump responded to the AP report by repeating his baseless claim that the election was stolen from him through voter fraud. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully listener supported and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com and please click on that donate button.